from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, how should police handle potentially violent people with mental illnesses? The U.S. Supreme Court is considering the case of a schizophrenic woman shot and seriously injured by San Francisco police officers a few years ago. Her attorneys argue that police violated her rights to special accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. The outcome of the case could have a sweeping impact on police training and handling of the mentally ill. That's our topic this hour on Forum, and we'll get started right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. Michael Krasny is away this week. Well, police officers are often confronted with people who have some kind of mental illness, and the outcome can be, to say the least, unpredictable. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court considered this question. Did San Francisco police officers violate the Americans with Disabilities Act when they first pepper sprayed and then shot a woman with a schizophrenic-like condition after she had threatened them with a knife? Or put another way, does the ADA require police to provide reasonable accommodations for people with mental illness, even in situations that are potentially violent? The case raises big questions for police departments across the country and for people with mental illness, of course. And we're going to have a whole panel weigh in on these questions in a moment. But I want to begin with Alex Emsley, a reporter with KQED News who's been covering this issue in the broad sense for some time now. Alex, good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
Take us back, if you would, to that day in 2008. What happened to this woman, Teresa Sheehan?
Well, it was August. She had gone at least a week displaying some kind of bizarre behavior, not showering. Her social worker called the police for assistance to get her a psychiatric evaluation. The police arrived. I'm sorry, I should step back for a moment. Her social worker called the police after she had threatened him with a knife to help her, to help get her into custody and taken in for a psychiatric evaluation.
And we should say she was living in a residence, a co-op, for people with mental illness.
That's correct, yes. After he was threatened, the social worker did clear the second floor of the building and then called police for assistance. Two San Francisco police officers showed up on scene and used the social worker's key to enter Teresa Sheehan's room. That is their first entry. Sheehan was calm, lying on her bed. By description, she had a book on her chest or near her face. The police officers told her they were there to help her, and she got up and aggressively told them to leave her room, pushed her door shut, and the officers were then standing outside in the hallway, and she was inside with a knife.
And so they wanted to get her out of the room.
That's what they said, and that they had an exigent circumstance to do so, that this was an emergency situation.
And the emergency was what?
They were concerned that she might be a threat, not to herself. That's a legal issue that gets confusing, but to the public safety and to the officers themselves. And so they did call for backup, but then before the backup or as the backup was arriving, decided to push in, knock in her door.
Break down the door, and they used pepper spray on her?
They were prepared with the pepper spray when they broke in the door, Sheehan was right there. So, yes, the initial use of force was pepper spray in her face. That did not stop her. She was still moving toward the officers, according to their account.
And she had a knife.
And she had a knife. And that is when they shot her five times.
So she didn't flee the room. They shot her in the room.
This altercation was happening right at the threshold of her room. She was shot. There was blood spray in her apartment. Some of it was happening outside her door, and some of this was happening inside her door.
Yeah. And so that was 2008. She ultimately sued the city, saying what?
She did sue the city after she was charged with assault and acquitted by a jury. But then she sued the city, saying that, as you said in your introduction, that the officers violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by failing to take her schizophrenia as a recognized disability under the ADA into account.
And of course, the ADA is a federal law, so they sued on her behalf in federal court, and the trial court judge was by coincidence, Charles Breyer, who's the brother of Stephen Breyer, the U.S. Supreme Court justice, and he dismissed the case.
He ruled on summary judgment in favor of San Francisco, the defendant.
And then it went up to the Ninth Circuit. I'm just kind of getting everybody on the same page here. Went up to the Ninth Circuit, and they said no. There were a couple of issues here, not just the fact that they should have accommodated her under the ADA, but also perhaps they shouldn't have broken into her room.
Right, under the Fourth Amendment. The sort of legal issues here, as I understand, are fairly related. The Fourth Amendment issue being that it was unreasonable to break into her room, given the fact that she was potentially violent and had this mental disability.
Yeah. And then just big picture, before we bring in our other guests, how common is this sort of thing where the police confront someone with mental illness, they're shot, sometimes they're killed? I mean, how frequent is that?
Well, national statistics are hard to come by on this. KQED investigated San Francisco officer-involved shootings between 2005 and 2013. We found 58% of the fatal incidents, that's 11 out of 19 people killed during that time, had a psychiatric disability that was a contributing factor to the incident. That's San Francisco Police Department's own distinction. The SFPD does track these statistics, unlike many other police departments, so we were able to get that number. I found it interesting that yesterday at the Supreme Court, Justice Sotomayor did mention statistics as well and said that approximately 350 people nationwide are killed every year who have this psychiatric disability as a contributing factor to the incident.
Okay. And so they heard that oral argument yesterday, and they're expected to rule on this question by the end of June, which is the end of their calendar. Let me bring in our other guest. That's Alex Emsley, by the way, reporter for KQED News, who's been covering this issue for some time now. Let me bring in our other guests. Claudia Center is a senior staff attorney with the Disability Rights Program for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also joining us, Angela Chan, who's a senior staff attorney with the Criminal Justice Reform Program at the Asian Law Caucus. She was also a former San Francisco Police Commissioner, and she spearheaded the crisis intervention training program that occurred after this shooting in 2008. Angela, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And also joining us by phone is Berkeley Police Officer Jeffrey Shannon. He also coordinates the city's crisis intervention team over there in the East Bay. And Officer Shannon, welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
And we should say that we did invite the city of San Francisco to join this conversation, and they declined. Let me begin, bring us back to yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court. Claudia Chan, I know the ACLU filed briefs in this case. What was your you weren't there, of course, and we don't have the audio, but we were able to look at the transcripts from what happened yesterday. What's your take on where the justices were, the kinds of concerns they expressed?
I think it's hard to say at this point. Every lawyer that stood up got hard questions. Scalia was very frustrated with what he perceived to be a modification or change in the city's position. So that took up a lot of the argument.
And the change, just briefly, was what?
Initially, the city...
He called it a bait and switch.
Yes, he called it a bait and switch, the technical term, he said.
He's very funny.
Yeah, he is funny. Basically, when they filed their brief, their petition, they suggested that the ADA did not apply at all to these situations. And then down the road with their merits briefing, they clarified that, yes, the ADA applies, but they just didn't think it applied in this situation.
And so they were saying, yes, it does apply during the arrest process.
Correct.
And so the court was not happy that they had sort of changed the court. They thought they were accepting a different case, in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Angela Chan, you were on the San Francisco Police Commission after the shooting. The shooting was in 2008. How did the department react not only to that shooting but to subsequent shootings involving mentally ill people?
There were quite a few problems in 2010 when I first joined the police commission. There were a couple high-profile shootings. Listeners might remember a gentleman in a wheelchair in front of the Department of Public Health in San Francisco who did not receive services, got upset, and the officers ended up shooting him in broad daylight. Lots of video online about this. That led to some protests actually by mental health providers and advocates. And then in 2011, we meaning the police commission, decided to take a serious look at the crisis intervention Prevention Team Program, which was something that San Francisco had been doing, but not completely, and actually had dropped in 2010. And what the Crisis Intervention Team Program is a specialized unit of officers, about 20 to 25% of patrol, who receive 40 hours of training. And it's not just a training program. These officers are then supposed to be the first responders. They're supposed to be dispatched by 911 when there is a call for service involving an individual experiencing a mental health crisis. And those officers are supposed to be very good at de-escalation and using communication. And really, to break it down and make it very simple, it's about using time and distance. There's no reason in many circumstances to rush in or to escalate the situation. Oftentimes, just like in the Teresa Sheehan case, the individual is scared. They might be hearing or seeing things, and they might pick up a knife, usually a small knife, to defend themselves, and will often lock themselves in a room or a bathroom. In those situations, there's no reason to rush in. The officers have plenty of time to plan and figure out if this person's off medication, what might get the get that person to calm down. And so that's a CIT, Crisis Intervention Team Program.
And at this point now, some, 7 years after the shooting, San Francisco Police Department has, about one in five police officers trained in crisis intervention?
It's about 20%. So the training has been going well. I just attended the training last week. They have about 3 to 4 trainings a year of a classes of about 20 to 30 officers. So that's been going well. And mental health providers in San Francisco have volunteered their time. We have numerous doctors who volunteer their time to provide these trainings at low or no cost at all to the department. The hard part is the operational piece. It's not just a training. The officers need to be dispatched. And if they receive the training and they're not dispatched when they're needed, then all of this falls apart.
And Officer Shannon, how has Berkeley implemented this kind of crisis intervention team? You're the coordinator of it. What was it that got Berkeley to do this?
Berkeley was began the process of developing a CIT way back in 2007 with our Berkeley Albany Mental Health Commission, making a recommendation to City Council that we develop a program. And it took a number of years through a steering committee to get it done. And at that time in Alameda County, there was no CIT.
CIT, Crisis Intervention Team.
Right, Crisis Intervention Team or Crisis Intervention Training. And so we developed our program right about the same time the Oakland Police Department was developing theirs. And so I want to say in 2010 was when we first started sending our officers through the county training, which is sponsored by the Oakland Police Department. And we've been sending our officers to that training ever since.
What difference has that made, you know?
You know, I think there's a pervasive myth, you know, that needs to be dispelled here. And the Sheehan case is very typical. It happens every day across the country where a law enforcement officer has an encounter with someone that has a mental illness, uses lethal force, the subject dies or doesn't die, and the media, the first thing that we're going to hear is they're going to say he or she had a mental illness. And the myth that goes with that is that we need to throw training at it, and that if officers have this extra training, these bad outcomes aren't going to happen. And now I teach crisis de-escalation in Alameda County, and one of the facts is that there are certain situations in which de-escalation, verbal de-escalation, is not only not advisable, it's dangerous.
Like what?
You know, if you're doing a traffic stop, for example, and the first thing the officer sees is the driver's door open up and a barrel of a gun coming out of the driver's side, and they're shooting, and this happens. So clearly we're not going to try to use verbal de-escalation in that situation. That's an extreme situation. But the point is de-escalation simply does not work every time.
And Angela Chan, that raises a good point because we ask police officers to do a lot. You know, they have to sometimes put their lives in danger to protect us, and they have to make split-second decisions sometimes. Do they deserve the benefit of the doubt in a situation like this?
Well, these situations, the one we're describing here, the Teresa Sheehan case, not this extreme circumstance that the officer has described of the traffic stop with the gun. The Teresa Sheehan case, which is quite common, because it happens so frequently, especially in San Francisco, which has a large population with mental illness needs, officers in the department should learn from that situation and try to figure out tactically and strategically what makes the most sense. And are we going to keep doing the same exact thing where within 30 seconds of the encounter, the person is shot and killed? Or Is there another way of doing this? And the Memphis model, this crisis intervention team model, it came from the Memphis Police Department after they had an incident in 1987. This has been shown in various cities to improve not just the police department response, but the mental health system response overall. Part of this work is also the department partnering with mental health providers and giving them feedback as to what happened once they tried to give the person services. So, for example, I went to SF General to try to give this person services. It took forever, and then they were checked out real soon after. For that to be a conversation that occurs regularly, so mental health providers can also understand what's happening within their system. It's a partnership. And I emphasize that de-escalation and communication is a very important skill. I think that's not trained enough and not used enough really nationally. It's the use of force continuum is overemphasized. This ratchet up the use of force if the person is not following your command. If someone is experiencing a mental illness crisis, oftentimes they don't understand the command. And so that's really not an effective strategy.
That's Angela Chan. She's a senior staff attorney with the Asian Law Caucus, former San Francisco Police Commissioner. We're talking with her along with KQED reporter Alex Emsley, Claudia Center from the ACLU, and Berkeley police officer Jeffrey Shannon, who is the coordinator for the city's crisis intervention team. And we're talking about how police officers should handle people with mental illness when they're potentially violent. That question before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday involving the case of a woman in San Francisco who was shot and injured by police some 7 years ago. One of the questions, Claudia Center, is that should the police have to offer reasonable accommodation under the ADA to someone who is mentally ill under a circumstance like this? What does that mean? What is a reasonable accommodation?
Well,
by police.
In this case, where the police officers were responding to a person contained in their home who was known to have a significant psychiatric disability, who was known to be in crisis, in this situation, we believe that the ADA would require following the de-escalation and the crisis intervention strategies. And I know you used the word unpredictable before, but in fact, these at-home confrontations are terribly predictable in that the same pattern occurs over and over, the exact same pattern that happened in Teresa Sheehan's case.
I was going to say what I meant by unpredictable is not just in that situation, but on the street or in a situation where there's other people in a building.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, these were what lawyers call bad facts for the city.
Yes, because she was at home, contained in her home, and they had a lot of information about her. And they also had an opportunity before they entered the room, either the first or the second time, to come up with a plan for taking the time and the patience to communicate and to work with her.
And Alex Emsley, disability, and I'm going to ask others this question as well, but disability rights groups are worried about this case. They're worried that the Supreme Court could issue a ruling that would affect people with disability mental illness more broadly. Is that the concern?
That's the impression that I'm getting. And, it's very difficult to predict how the Supreme Court might rule, and they have very many options in this case. But I think one that is of great concern to advocacy groups is that they could weaken protections that are already the law of the land, at least in the Ninth Circuit under the Americans with Disabilities Act, when it comes to these kind of confrontations. The other side of that is that there is a hope that if the ADA, which is this sort of obscure federal law, right? I mean, it has a lot to do with a lot of things in our lives, but it's a very complicated, big statute, right? But if that were a requirement to be followed nationwide, it could create an incentive for police departments, unlike San Francisco and Berkeley, that don't have these programs, to create them,
to prevent that kind of innovation or that kind of intervention.
A ruling in San Francisco's favor could possibly stifle something, and a ruling in Teresa Sheehan's favor could create an incentive to broaden these kind of responses.
Officer Shannon, why would a police department not want to do this? I mean, it seems like any time, anything that could be done that's shown to be best practices that de-escalates issues, that reduces shootings and injuries and potentially harm to officers, why, no matter what the outcome of this case is, why would a police department not want to do what Berkeley and San Francisco have done?
That's a good question. It's one I have for myself as well. I don't think there is really any good reason not to have additional CIT training. the training kind of sells itself when police executives, chiefs of police, sheriffs get to really understand what the program is. And at this point, it's there's not that much difficulty in selling the program. So,
it's maybe a cost question.
Yeah, the thing is, in the basic police academy that every officer gets, there's really not enough training on interacting with mentally ill subjects in a helpful, effective way. There's the training there is very minimal. So clearly there's a need for this extra training.
Alex? Go ahead.
Just really quickly, the other thing is that the perception that the CIT officers are going to get their, a magic wand out and make everything safe. We have officers in the city of Berkeley who are not CIT trained, who are outstanding with their interpersonal skills and their communication skills. They're not in the program, but they're outstanding. And so, again, I'm a firm believer in the CIT training, but I just want to get away from the idea that it's a panacea for this issue.
Alex?
Well, and I should say that in this Teresa Sheehan case, too, during that first entry that the police officers made, it's my understanding from their testimony in depositions and such that they really did try to implement some of the de-escalation techniques that I know Jeff Shannon teaches in the East Bay. But I was just curious because he mentioned, Jeff, you mentioned state training certified by the state of California Post, right?
Right.
Do you think that it would be beneficial if it was required by the state that police departments have a crisis intervention team program, or if they bumped up the training at the academy level to include some of the things that you teach?
Yeah, Post right now is kind of looking over the learning domain, the one that has to do with this issue, to kind of reconfigure it. I don't know if there's a plan to mandate additional training. I will say that there are a number of states across the country where they have mandated CIT-like training for every single sworn officer. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're going that direction. The one part about the training that's important is difficult to mandate it across the state because one of the key aspects of CIT is diversion. That is to say, to divert people with mental health challenges away from the criminal justice system where they don't need to be and back into the community mental health system. And the problem with mandating across the state is, of course, the resources vary from community to community. So that would be a challenge.
We're coming up on a break here, but quickly, Angela Chan, I think police officers sometimes feel that their hands are tied in dealing with issues like this or the homeless, depending on where they are, that they would like to have more flexibility than sometimes local policy requires. What is your sense of how the police department in San Francisco is responding to this issue now that it's had a chance to work its way all the way up to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think the police department has started crisis intervention team training, and also Chief Sir, once he became chief, really quickly issued a bulletin asking officers to slow down when someone might be just a danger to themselves and not someone else.
All right. Well, we'll pick that back up after the break. And if you want to join this conversation, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments and questions to forum at kqed.org. And of course, you can send us a question on Twitter and on Facebook as well. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. We hope you stick around. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're talking about police officers and people with mental illness, how they should deal with those folks when they're potentially violent. A case heard yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court involving the shooting of a schizophrenic woman in San Francisco by San Francisco police officers. Joining us for this hour, Alex Emsley, reporter with KQED News, who's been covering this for many, many months. I think it's fair to say years, probably, Alex, by this point. Claudia Center with the American Civil Liberties Union. They're opposing the city's appeal of this case. In the lower court ruling, Angela Chan, staff attorney with the Criminal Justice Reform Program of the Asian Law Caucus. She's also a former San Francisco police commissioner. And Berkeley police officer Jeffrey Shannon, who heads up their crisis intervention team. If you'd like to join us, the number to call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And as always, you can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Claudia Center, what is at stake here in this case? We don't know, of course, how it's going to turn out, but what could happen and what could the ramifications be?
I think there's a lot at stake. There are at least several hundred people with disabilities killed by police nationwide every year. The data is hard to come by, but we know it's several hundred. Most of those people are people with psychiatric disabilities. Some are people with intellectual disabilities or autism or who are deaf and hard of hearing. And we really need the ADA as a tool to encourage police departments and municipalities to incorporate these safer strategies. Advocates and, for example, the U.S. Department of Justice use the ADA as the legal framework when they come in and try to negotiate with localities to put this into place.
And so is there a dispute whether the ADA applies even to the arrest phase of an interaction with police?
Well, that's a good question. We think that it's clear that the ADA applies to arrests and detentions, such as the one in Ms. Sheehan's case. But there are people, there are advocates before the court who argued in amicus briefs that it doesn't apply to the details of an arrest.
And do you get a sense that the court is reviewing all of that?
Yes, I think so. As we talked about before, Justice Scalia asked a lot of questions about whether that issue was still in play.
All right. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll begin in Marin County, Mill Valley. Frank is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about the bad fact situation. If Sheehan is a clear illustration of the police being warned before they start contact that the person is mentally ill, would you agree that the random confrontation on the street is different because the officer doesn't have a warning as to whether the guy's crazy or belligerent, and should there be a different protocol?
Claudia Center, you want to take that?
Yes, definitely. It's all going to depend on the information and the opportunity that the officers have. So if there isn't information or if there isn't an opportunity to implement the safer strategies, then those practices would potentially not be applicable.
And Officer Shannon, to what extent are police officers in Berkeley trained to distinguish between those kinds of situations?
One of the parts of the training is the CIT training is recognizing the signs and symptoms of mental illness. And so that's a component. But the other thing for us is that we have, because of our demographics, so many folks with mental health challenges in our city that without the training, we are very kind of expert at this point at recognizing those signs and symptoms. And part of it is just being able to talk to people and find out what's going on. Of course, everything that goes into an assessment about what's going on with a person can happen in less than 30 seconds. So, you know, it depends on, you know, what the demographics of your area are. But because we have so many in the city of Berkeley, we're pretty good at it.
Frank, does that respond to your call or your question?
It does. In fact, it kind of surprises me about the officer being so confident. I think that's reassuring, but it would seem to lock them into the ADA because they have a higher probability of the person being crazy than not, it sounds like.
Angela Chan, how has the training evolved with the San Francisco Police Department? I mean, I would imagine that with more experience and more studies and all more data that it changes to help perhaps answer the kinds of questions that and situations that the caller was referring to.
Well, an ideal crisis intervention team training, and these are not uniform across the country, but an ideal one would include a lot of role plays. And the role plays should try to mimic as much as possible the scenarios the officers might encounter while on duty. And what would be ideal is that they incorporate best practices that the officers develop as they're engaging in these various situations. And going back to Frank's question from Marin, I wanted to point out also that it's important that 911 or Department of Emergency Management, which often is separate from the police department, that when they receive the call for service, they ask questions to determine if the person is experiencing a mental health crisis so that officers receive this information ahead of time before going to the scene.
All right. We've got some listener email as well. Alex writes, in a confrontation with police, the officers need to protect themselves and the public. Certainly, they could do a better job of this at times, but when someone comes at you with a knife or points a gun at you or another person, the use of deadly force is justified. You don't need to, quote, accommodate someone in that situation. You shoot. Claudia, that's basically what Justice Scalia was saying yesterday, isn't it?
Right, but I think we need to take a step back. Once you've gotten to the point where you're shooting or where the other person is reaching for a household item to employ as a weapon, at that point you've wasted your opportunity. You want to take a step back in terms of time and say, you know, when you know that this is your situation, let's have a plan.
All right, Alex, yeah.
Well, there is some indication that the use of de-escalation tactics, like what is taught in this crisis intervention team training, is actually safer for officers as well as for the people that they're responding to. And I had another question for Officer Jeff Shannon as well. From the point of view of the officers that were responding to that apartment in 2008, they had a large concern that there may be elements of danger, possibly another person, possibly other weapons that were in the room that they didn't get a chance to see. And I wonder if you could just speak to that perspective.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. We're Monday morning quarterbacking this incident from the perspective of the consumer, which is important. But absolutely, you know, someone mentioned earlier, Miss Sheehan had a small knife. Well, for us, a small knife is a deadly weapon. There's no doubt that a small knife can kill you. I mean, if you look in prisons, you know, the shanks that they use, for example, are considered small knives. So it's a deadly weapon. The questions I would have is, did the officers know that there was nobody else in the room? If we know that Miss Sheehan is psychotic, threatening to kill people and has a knife, I would want to know, is there anybody else in there? And what's my verification that there's nobody else in the room? If the social worker says, no, I don't think there's anybody else in the room, that's probably not good enough.
Was there any indication, Alex, how the social worker reacted to what the police officers did when they got there? He must have testified or given a deposition, right?
Not that I know of. No, I don't know what his reaction was to how the officers reacted. I know that he did call the officers and with the expectation that Teresa Sheehan would be taken safely into custody for a psychiatric evaluation.
All right, let's go back to the...
I heard earlier that one of the officers said, we're here to help you or something along those lines, and that's clearly a de-escalation tactic. And was there an escape route? You know, was there a window she could get out? Because, again, if she's a danger to other people and there's a way for her to get out of her room, that creates an exigency.
Yeah. And Angela Chan, I know this may be sort of random, but my understanding is that both police officers were women. Is that correct?
That appears to be the case. And to answer officer's question about whether there was an escape route, my understanding is that in this case, Teresa Sheehan was on the second floor. There was a window, but it wasn't clear if there's any way she could have gotten out that window on the second floor.
There was no escape route. I've actually seen the window. I've been to the building. And from my point of view, the officers, knowing that there was a crisis situation, should have taken time ahead of time to kind of survey the premises and get an understanding before they started acting.
I pointed out the gender of the officers just because, you know, we hear oftentimes, not just as police officers, but in the world, women tend to be more conciliatory. They're better communicators. I mean, is there any indication, Angela, in terms of training, I will open this up to anybody, that either men or women respond to the training and to the notion of being de-escalators differently?
Well, I've sat in on almost every single crisis intervention team training the police department has given in San Francisco, and I've seen both male and female officers receive the training and give the training. I haven't seen a difference. I think what it makes a difference is the patience of the officer, the seniority of the officer in terms of their experience on the streets, because, again, these incidences are not unpredictable because they happen regularly, and oftentimes the facts are very similar.
Alex, quickly, then we want to go to pause.
Oh, it just brings up an interesting point that many crisis intervention team programs like the one in Berkeley that I understand are all volunteer for that reason. They want officers that want to do this, that are sort of naturally inclined to do this type of work.
Oh, and any idea, just not to put too fine a point on it, but Jeffrey Shannon, Officer Shannon, is there any, do you find men or women more interested in volunteering?
No, I don't. I wouldn't feel comfortable generalizing about that. We have a good mix.
Okay, good. All right, back to the phones. Linda in Oakland, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to bring into the discussion the fact that there are many more people with developmental disabilities out in the community now. I have a 21-year-old son with autism who is nonverbal, who has the potential for behavior issues. And we have had encounters with the police in the community, and they seem to have a generic approach to consider that anybody having a behavior issue in the community has a mental health issue. My son was almost tased. So I just want to bring into the discussion that not only are people with mental health issues in need of more understanding than out in the community, but people with developmental disabilities who may not respond to verbal commands, who may run away, et cetera. I just want to make sure that this is brought into the discussion.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Officer Shannon, is that part of the training?
It is. Yeah, it's definitely covered in the CIT training, and it's a good point she makes.
Yeah, all right. Linda, thanks very much for bringing that to our attention.
And I should say it's also Angela? Definitely a part of the training in San Francisco. The mental health providers were very clear that developmental disability is a big piece of our training. Also, special needs of elderly population, which might be experiencing some concerns, and also for young folks who might have trauma from their lives.
And how are they trained to deal with people who are autistic, for example, and may not be able to communicate or may get agitated?
We have specialists in that area come in and explain how to best communicate with people who have autism, because your usual commands of, you know, sit down, put your hands up where we can see them, they might not understand it if you just communicate it in that way.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Santa Clara, Uddy is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is, I think, is broader than the discussion. It's about non-lethal measures. Now, I understand from the story and the details that pepper spray was deployed, but what about things like tasers, which would have resolved the situation with much less harmful consequences? And if you take this to a broader question about all latest officer-related shootings, I think that having been given means other than a gun to resolve those issues, we might have seen different outcomes.
Angela Chan?
Instead of, but in addition to.
Yeah.
Yeah, tasers have been hotly debated in San Francisco. The issues come before the police commission and police chief probably at least 3 or 4 times, even on my 4 years on the commission. The police department, the chief ultimately decided to not adopt tasers because tasers, when used on somebody taking certain medications with any kind of alcohol or drugs in their system, with heart conditions, if they're elderly, if they, you know, all sorts of things, if they're frail, if they're thin, can actually be deadly or cause serious harm. Also, tasers often are not effective when someone's experiencing a mental health crisis. It might not have the same reaction someone else might have. Tasers don't just freeze the folks. It also often makes the person fall down onto the ground, which then results in further injury. And that's why Taser International, the producer of tasers, have been sued and have had to pay out quite a bit of money for that.
Yeah, Alex?
I just thought that brings up an interesting point that was also discussed at the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. Justice Scalia was asking, you know, what it meant that the officers first went to pepper spray and said, you know, why does that indicate that this was going to lead to a lethal outcome or a potentially lethal outcome? He says, was this defective pepper spray? What was the matter here? And the attorney for Ms. Sheehan's side said that the Ninth Circuit has gone into this issue. He says, if I get shot with pepper spray, I'm on the ground dropping whatever knives I have. But when mentally ill individuals get shot with pepper spray, they don't always process it the same way. Sometimes they see it as a threat, and sometimes they act irrationally.
Well, and it did seem to, Claudia, to escalate the situation very much so, right?
Yes, the non-lethal weapons are not a magic pill for the situation. They can be part of the escalation.
Yeah, all right.
Just step in here real quick.
Yeah.
You know, the ASP baton is sometimes not effective unless it's used correctly. If you have a focused aggressor, pepper spray is not going to work. None of our tools are perfect. I think it's, you know, at the risk of sounding cynical here, you have a situation where the city of San Francisco doesn't want to have tasers, doesn't want to have another effective tool on the officer's tool belt, but then it's going to hold, you know, because the question is, if you have somebody who's threatened to kill you, who's psychotic and has a knife and is within several feet of you, charging you, would you rather use a taser or your a handgun? I mean, clearly you're going to use the handgun that you have, but if they had a taser, it would be an option. So you take that option away from us, and then you hold us accountable when we go to the next force option that we have. So that to me is, you know, there's only a few areas, a few municipalities in the Bay Area that don't have tasers, and I think that's too bad.
Some more comments from our listeners. David writes, I find it shocking that only 20% of police are trained in handling situations with the mentally ill. Our country pushes most of these ill people out on the street, so why aren't all police officers trained in managing these people? And then Susan writes, please ask the Berkeley police officer about Kayla Moore. She was a very obese, transgendered black woman with known mental health issues. She was killed by Berkeley police officers in her apartment in Berkeley a couple of years ago. Officer Shannon?
Yeah, let me just get to the first one. You know, why aren't more officers trained because there's so many people with mental health challenges on the street? I mean, another question is, why aren't we talking about the services, the monies needed to fund community mental health treatment, get more inpatient psychiatric beds, because we are overwhelmed. You know, police officers want to do the right thing. We're in the helping profession, so we're there for the right reason. But when you have so many very sick people on our streets with nowhere to divert them, you're going to have a situation where you're going to have bad outcomes. And the Kayla Moore case, yeah. I can't comment on that because that's still being litigated.
Okay. Alex, do you know anything about that case?
I did some reporting on it. It was not a shooting case. This was a case of an in-custody death. Several Berkeley police officers responded to kind of a similar situation in that it was at a person's home. There had been a dispute with her roommate or housemate at the time. When the officers arrived, things escalated very quickly, and as I think it was 7 or 8 police officers were trying to take her into custody, had handcuffed her behind her back, Kayla Moore stopped breathing. The coroner in that case ruled that the cause of death was due to a combined acute drug overdose. And complicated by Kayla Moore's other physical health issues.
All right, let's try to get another couple comments in here. Susan writes, I've heard that police get 6 hours of training to help them deal with mental health issues, which is clearly inadequate. Ultimately, police should not be in the business of mental health assessment and containment. Does anyone know how much this program has increased since the dismantlement of psychiatric services during and since President Reagan, or actually Governor Reagan, I think it was at the time. But Angela, what are your thoughts about that? How much training is enough?
Well, we wanted to emphasize that it's not just training. It is the operational piece. It's making sure that officers are dispatched that have these special skills. And the reason 20 to 25% of patrol is required to have CIT is that not all officers necessarily have the disposition to be CIT officers. There are some that have more patience and better communication skills than others, and we want to select those officers for an elite cadre of CIT officers, and they will lead the effort. Of course, their partners and other officers will support that effort. In terms of basic training for all officers, the Police Commission in 2011 did mandate that all officers receive a basic number of hours of training. I believe it was about 8 to 16 hours of training, and also to receive retraining every several years. And that is important, especially because the San Francisco Police Department has many new officers coming in right now.
All right, back to the phones. And Samik in Menlo Park, welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a decision analyst from Menlo Park, and I wanted to broaden the frame a little bit that this problem is probably unfairly being seen as just a police problem. And in particular, in Oakland, I know of friends who've started this this house called the Casa de Paz, or the House of Peace. It's situated in a very violent neighborhood, and they basically meditate, and then they invite the community there to farm with them. And they've told me several stories where situations which could have gotten very violent were quickly de-escalated because they went in and with a lot of love, they hugged people and then they just calmed people down. So I was wondering in this conversation, what is the opportunity and could the police see themselves as partners promoting such groups and leveraging the powerful practices of nonviolent communication and meditation to improve the situation?
Well, and I want to just say, I think some schools are also teaching de-escalation. It's not, obviously, it's not just for police departments, but Angela, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yes. So I've been saying over and over again that crisis intervention team isn't just a training, it's operational, but it's also a partnership. It's something that doesn't just belong to the police department. I think Officer Shannon would agree with me on this. It's something that involves a strong partnership with mental health providers who, at the end of the day, are responsible for providing the services to people experiencing crisis. It's the officers that might be the first responders, but it really they're supposed to refer people out to these necessary services.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Is it Clay in San Francisco?
Yes, that's right. Hi, my name is Clay Hathaway. I was actually the trial attorney for Teresa Sheehan. And I've been listening, and I wanted to just to make sure that everyone had the facts correct, because I spent many months on this trial. First of all, there was no pepper spray ever used. One of the police officers was an experienced sergeant. She'd been on the force for over 10 years. And the less than lethal force that the San Francisco Police Department had at the front door, less than probably 30 seconds away, the beanbag guns, they were actually at the front door of this house. And these two officers forced their way into Ms. Sheehan's room on the second try and shot her. It wasn't five times, it was seven times. And in the last comment, there was no exigency. She was not a threat to anyone. She had no history of being suicidal, and there was absolutely no way she could threaten anyone outside. She was in her room, and she wanted to be left alone. She needed some help, but she didn't need to be shot seven times.
Let me just ask you, since a non-legal question, I believe she was at the Supreme Court yesterday. How's she doing?
I have been in touch with her sister. I don't actually know exactly how she's doing. She looks from the photographs that she's doing great. She's actually out of the wheelchair, which is an amazing thing.
And she had been injured, was it in the leg? Where was she shot exactly?
She was actually shot in the head, in the torso four times, and in the leg.
Wow. That's amazing that she's doing as well as she is. Well, thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Let's see if we can... in the time left, get another call or two in. Bruce, in Davis, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Here in Yolo County, we have a problem with the homeless mentally ill. And they've enacted a controversial law, Laura's Law, which enables these healthcare providers to detain and treat people who they suspect may be violent, either to themselves or others. I just wanted someone to comment on that, whether they feel that's effective or is a breach of rights or in any way can be useful in eliminating some of these problems.
Anybody want to take that? I believe San Francisco has also adopted Laura's Law, right? That's a county-by-county decision that a few counties have decided on.
Right. Right now, it's county-by-county. And, you know, from our point of view, we need to fully fund voluntary mental health services. Those are the most effective.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Anybody else want to add anything on that? We've got some more listener comments here. Robin writes, my teenage daughter suffers from extreme mental illness, and we've had numerous positive interactions with Berkeley's police officers because of their excellent training in how to handle mental health crises. Mental health workers who work with us and work throughout Alameda County agree with me and that Berkeley police are particularly well-trained and manage these crises well. Kudos to you, Officer Shannon. And then Fred writes, I have an 11-year-old son who has mental health problems and often becomes aggressive when he feels threatened. As my son gets older, I worry more and more about what may happen with police interaction. When he becomes aggressive, interaction with him of any kind will only escalate him. Biggest mistake anyone can make with an aggressive mental health patient is to try to intervene. There's no limit to the level it can escalate. What do you take from that sort of a comment, Jeffrey Shannon?
You know, I think the question is, do we need to be here? Excuse me, do we need to be here right now? Is this a situation where law enforcement needs to be at this door, at this apartment? But it is a truism that if you use the same kind of communication tactics that are taught in the academy to somebody who's experiencing, say, auditory hallucinations or psychotic or not in reality, that oftentimes that is going to backfire. You know, so the way that police interact with mentally ill people is changing fairly rapidly, and I think overall we're doing a very good job.
Claudia Center with the ACLU, you said that there's a concern, of course, that the ACLU has that depending on how broad this ruling is, it could stifle police departments. They may feel no incentive to implement these kinds of programs if it turns out that the Supreme Court says the ADA doesn't apply in these sorts of situations. What is the ACLU doing, if you know, across the country in terms of dealing with other police departments? I mean, is San Francisco, how unique are San Francisco and Berkeley in this regard of taking this on?
I think almost every police department, including San Francisco, has a long way to go before they've fully implemented these strategies. And so I think there's a lot of work to do. And we really need the ADA to be one of our tools.
And Angela Chan, any sense of whether this is informing the San Francisco Police Department in any way as going forward?
Yeah, no police officer wants to kill an individual, and it impacts the officers for a long term. Officers often will themselves experience post-traumatic stress, depression, suicidal feelings after being involved in this type of shooting. And so I think Chief Sir, when he first became chief and issued that department bulletin asking officers to slow down and to call a sergeant to the scene when an individual poses only a threat to themselves and not anyone else, that's recognizing that importance of safety for the officer as well as the individual. So we're moving in the right direction, but more needs to be done.
All right. Angela Chan with the Asian Law Caucus. Thanks to you. Thanks also to Claudia Center from the ACLU, Alex Emsley from KQED News, and Officer Jeffrey Shannon with the Berkeley Police Department. And we'll find out how this all works out by the end of June. Thanks to all of you very much for coming in. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement supervisor, editor rather, is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.